Hi, everyone. My name is Red Aldridge. I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome that young man that introduced himself as a newcomer. You know, there's no way in the world that I'd ever try to stand up here and tell anybody in this room whether they're alcoholic or not. I don't believe I'm qualified to do that. However, if you happen to start identifying with some of these innermost feelings I'm going to try to describe, some of these symptoms of this terminal disease that I have, I would sure as hell pay attention. Because what we're dealing with here is a terminal disease. Just roll that over your tongue a couple of times. That's got kind of a final ring to it. Means that if you continue to use and abuse the mind-altering drug alcohol, and don't let anybody ever kid you that alcohol is not a drug. Alcohol falls right in the drug category with the ethers and the anesthetics. It's one of the oldest known drugs to man. And it's probably been used and abused by man longer than any other drug. And for sure, it's killed more men and women than any other drug. I used it, and I abused it, over a period of time, regardless of how long it took, until I actually broke my tolerance to it. If you're new, and you're wondering why alcohol has been giving you so much trouble physically, it's because you've become allergic to the drug alcohol. When Old Red drinks alcohol, I break out in spots. Spots like Acapulco, Las Vegas. In other words, once I pick up the first drink of that mind-altering drug, I can no longer predict my behavior. And if you've been having trouble along those lines, I can guarantee you that this afternoon you're in the right place. This physical allergy that I developed to this drug is not necessarily what makes it the killer that it is today. There's a mental side of this disease, and it's the real serious one. It's called the obsession of the mind, and it's triggered, incidentally, by the first drink of that mind-altering drug that you pick up that tells you that this time it's going to be different. This is the time I'll be able to predict. This is the time I'll be able to control. This is the time it's going to work for me like it always used to. See, if you be alcoholic like Red, and you pick up that first drink, you trigger your obsession to drink. In the alcoholic, it'll immediately set up a compulsion to drink, and you're going to end up, maybe not today, maybe not even this week. Once you trigger that obsession, once you set up that compulsion, you're going to end up in another devastating bout with this mind-altering drug, in which you're just one step closer to the insanity and death that Jan was reading about a minute ago when she read from that portion of chapter 5 from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the whole idea, if you're new, the whole concept of the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous is to teach us on a daily basis how to stay away from that first drink. You know, the first 100 guys and a gal that were able to do this successfully a day at a time for a year got together and they wrote down what they had done. They called it the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to believe that that first 100 guys and a gal had to be spiritually led. So over a period of the last 30 years that Red has been sober a day at a time, I have never found myself in a situation that I couldn't find the solution to in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous before it was necessary for me to go out there and pick up that first drink. And almost all the answers come in those 12 suggested steps that Jan read a minute ago. Those are the suggested steps to recovery used by that first 100 guys and a gal that were able to stay sober a day at a time for a year. If you were paying any attention at all when they were read, they are suggested steps to recovery. But I can guarantee you that there's not a guy or a gal in a room like this afternoon with any length of sobriety at all that ever had them just suggested to them. You're going to have to take them. You're going to have to do the best you can with them on a daily basis for the rest of your life if you want to become a survivor. Take a look around you in a room like this this afternoon, and what you see are the survivors of a terminal disease, a disease from which there is no cure, a progressive disease that's going to continue to get worse for the rest of your life, whether you drink or not. If you wonder why Red's standing up here this afternoon still yapping about the same old thing after going on 30 years of sobriety, it's because it's a hell of a lot more important for me to stay sober today than when I was in that first 30 or 60 or 90 days. Because you see, my disease has continued to progress. I had a very dear buddy with 22 years try it not too long ago. That lady started to drink at 10 in the morning, and by 4 that afternoon she was dead. Just 6 hours for the allergy of alcohol to wipe her right off the face of this earth after 22 years of sobriety. I said a minute ago, regardless of how long it took, I say that from podiums anymore because I look at these audiences, they keep getting younger on me all the time. I think it's probably because I'm getting so damned old. I don't know. But a lot of times I think people think that they got here too soon. And if you're thinking like that, my God, forget it. The average age of death today of the guy or the gal with a disease called alcoholism is down to 37. Take a look around you. You see a lot of us old jokers still staggering around. So you know how many kids have got to be dying to bring it down to anything like that. It's not extraordinary at all anymore for somebody to go through the gates of insanity and death before their 16th birthday. Coupled with some of that crap that's out there on the street this afternoon pushing this progression along, it's not hard to pack 20 years of hard drinking into 4 or 5. So if you are in a room like this afternoon, for God's sake, try to pay attention to some of these symptoms I'm going to try to describe. Some of these innermost feelings, and maybe, just maybe, you might save yourself a lot of hell right here on earth. And I'll get off of this bleeding deacon kick and qualify myself as an alcoholic. I like to get those licks in because sometimes we get carried away with these war stories and we forget what the real basis of this program is all about. I didn't do any drinking at an early age. I had an obsession. I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly the fastest airplanes ever built. I had a real drawback. I was born back in what they call the Depression years. I know a lot of you aren't even old enough to remember them. Have a feeling you might have had a little touch of them here lately. Things were tough. I knew my chances were that great. I started investigating. It seemed to be my only chance. It had to be the military. Except back in those days, we didn't have an Air Force, per se. It was part of what was called the Old Army Air Corps. I found to even get into it, I was going to have 2 years of college and a senatorial appointment from the state to get into the academy. I knew the money wasn't going to be there for that college education due to the times. I was no great student, but I was a big kid. I figured I could do it athletically. I stayed clean all the way through high school. I was out for football and basketball. I was lucky enough to win my football scholarship to Colorado State University. I wangled my 2 years of college that way, got my senatorial appointment, and they sent me to Randolph Field, which was the old Army Air Corps Academy. And they kept me real busy for the rest of my training. And through that period of my life, booze was no problem. I just didn't use it. I graduated as a second lieutenant back in the old Army Air Corps just prior to us getting into World War II. See a few guys sitting out there this afternoon that can probably remember how unprepared we were for that hassle. You know, our dads were supposed to fought one to end them all, and Congress had never seen too fit to appropriate the kind of a show we've got today. We got tossed into that North African campaign over there against a bunch of guys that had been sitting there practicing for a couple of years, and they got real good at what they were doing. We were strictly under-trained and for sure under-airplaned. I found myself in a situation on that first tour in which a lot of times we were putting up 25 against 200, and we were getting the hell kicked out of us. I came back off of one of those raids very early in that first tour of duty, and that particular day we only got 8 back out of the 25. Now, I think a lot of you can identify with adrenaline, Mother Nature's drug, usually triggered by fear, fear of death, fear of failure, fear of the unknown. You get a near miss out here on the freeway, you handle it real good. You get a half mile down the road, you can't keep your foot on the accelerator, you know. That's adrenaline. And I'd been in nothing but an adrenaline-type situation for about 6 hours. I was standing in an interrogation line waiting to go in to talk to him about what had happened. And old Red was shaking. I was shaking in every bone in my body. Now, I wasn't too worried about adrenaline shakes. I'd had them before. You stand there and wait for that football to come down with that 250-pound lineman about to nail you, and you'll quiver. I don't give a damn who you are. But you get in the game, and you get over it. And I knew I'd get over it. But this flight surgeon standing there looking at me wasn't that sure. He says, "What's the matter, Red?" I said, "Nothing. I'll be all right." He looked at me for a few minutes. He says, "Young man, I got just what you need." Now, I had never paid any attention to that medicinal table that they had set up there in operations. But on it, they had about a half a dozen open fifths of what they call medicinal whiskey. Think about that for a few minutes. Whiskey's a medicine. Reached over and he picked up a water glass and he poured me about two fingers and he said, "Here, drink this." And I looked at him and said, "I really don't want it." He looked me right in the eye and he says, "Young man, I prescribe it." Man, I hung on to that one for the next 20 years. I picked that stuff up, turned it up, drank it, walked on into interrogation and sat down. And if you got an alcoholic personality like I have, I think you know what happened. Man, that stuff sat there and flowed out to those fingertips and out there to those toes. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there real comfortable. I looked down and they were roped. You know, 10 minutes before, I hadn't been able to light a cigarette or pick up a cup of coffee. 10 minutes down the line with a half a glass of booze in me, I'm looking at them and they're frozen, just like they are this afternoon. Literally, old Red never shook at anything again for the next 20 years. I thought I had found the elixir of life. I really believed it, and booze worked that well for me for a long, long time. Even after it started doing to me, it would still do for me. I soon found to get the full benefit out of it, I had to keep recreating the same kind of a situation I'd had that first day. Probably combat's the best adrenaline builder I ever found before or since. I became a combat freak. I stayed 3 years and two tours of duty, and I got good at what I was doing. I learned to live on that knife's edge, that fast lane. Booze was always there at the end of the day to handle anything that I couldn't. God, I'd come in at night and see guys sitting on the edge of their beds worried about going the next day. You know, and I'd look at them and think, geez, I wish they could find alcohol. It never dawned on me that it worked so much better for me than it did for them. I went right on through World War II. I was back here in the States. I probably should have been able to lay that medication down and go on about my business. But in retrospect, I think I started running into one of the first symptoms of this disease. Some of you might identify with it. It's called justification. You know, rather than laying it down, I went looking for a job that had some adrenaline in it. All the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes that we got today, were just coming off the drawing boards. They were looking for guys that had a lot of combat experience to evaluate them. I put my application in, got accepted as a test pilot to the Proving Ground Command, and hell, the excitement was back. You know, I was flying the kind of airplanes now that I'd laid on those Colorado hillsides and dreamt about when I was a kid. I was flying with the best, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. In fact, I think it started working just a little bit too well. Proving Ground Command is Eglin Field in Florida. In fact, it still is. They got a big officers club built right out there in the Gulf there at Fort Walton. I used to catch myself an awful lot of nights hanging out at that club until 1 o'clock in the morning, just kind of tranquilizing the day. I'd know I had a 6:30 test op. Now, not always for sure. But every once in a while, I'd wake up in that BOQ at around 10 o'clock in the morning with that cold sweat start we come to in. I'd look at my watch and say, "Did I or didn't I?" You know, you'd pick up the phone, call the sergeant and say, "Did you get everything written up they wanted this morning?" "Yes, sir," right down the line. You walk back down to the line, step up on the wing of that bird, and the knee pad is yours. The checkoffs are yours. Signature is yours. Geometer says you've been up to speed of sound, and the only thing you can't recall is going. Now, don't kid me, it hadn't happened to you. You step out there on that porch in the morning, that car sitting in the driveway, you say, "How did it get home last night?" Or, "How did I get home last night?" It's called blackout, another symptom of this disease. Overuse and abuse of the mind-altering drug alcohol to the point that it blacks out the conscious mind. If you've got any coordination at all, you're going to get by with a mile of it. I've seen guys go for a week in a blackout, and you'd never see them stagger, and yet they had no conception of where they were or what they were doing. It should just scare the living hell out of an alcoholic, and I don't believe I've ever found one that it bothered too much. We write her off the idea that, God, I must have had a good time last night. The occupation that I was in, I knew it wasn't what I was looking for. I started my first feeble attempts at control. I'd always been a binge drinker at the end of the day. I figured if I was going to exercise control at all, I had to string it out over a longer period of time. And I think this is how an awful lot of us become daily drinkers. I gave up binge-type drinking, but I didn't give up drinking. I just strung it out over a longer period, and it worked great for a lot of years. Most of the real good airplanes I'd really wanted to test were off the drawing board anyway. I was looking for something maybe had a little more kick to it. As usual, the Air Force come up with it. We found out we'd let way too many guys out right after World War II. They started a big recruiting campaign to get the key personnel to come back. One of the promotional aspects they come up with was the organization of what's still known today as the Air Force Demonstration Team. Probably most of you have seen that team at one air show or another around the country. You don't get sentenced to that team. You volunteer for it. I had all the qualifications. I put my application in and I got accepted. It's not all fun and games. You practice at that stuff 4.5 days a week. Fly 32 air shows around the country a year at that time. They're up to 48 now. But I was back flying with the best again, and I knew it. They only let you do it for 2 years because it's an adrenaline-building son of a gun. I think I started running into another symptom about this time. Though some of you might identify with it. It's called hangover. God, I have never found, and this is before or since, a worse place to shake a hangover than an aerobatic formation. You just think about it for a few minutes. You walk out there in the morning, that canopy comes down over you, and you're trapped. There's no way in the world you're going to stop at a corner tavern. That's for damn sure. You hook that oxygen mask across your face, and you can no longer become ill. You pull into that 18-inch interval formation, and those guys just insist that you don't shake. You do a lot of, maybe you might identify with this, and it's called the deep sweats. You know, I used to sit there and wonder, how come? How come something that's worked for me so well for so long is kicking me around like this? I used to try to analyze it. Kind of thing, hell, maybe it's the life you lead, Rhett. Maybe at the end of your 2 years, if you'd resign, get out, get in the civilian life, get a business going, get a family started, do the things I'd seen my buddies do, that I could get a handle on this drinking. I always believed right up until I had both feet through the gates of insanity and death that given the right set of circumstances, I could control my drinking. I think this philosophy of self-sufficiency that we all grew up with from kids where every guy and every gal should be an island to themselves is probably what helps about 14 to 16 million of practicing alkies that are out there this morning self-medicate themselves right out of this world without ever finding what we find in rooms like this, that there is a way out. I finished my 2 years. I resigned. I hit civilian life. All my buddies had been out there about 4.5 to 5.5 years ahead of me. They'd got out right after World War II. They'd gone back to school. They'd completed their educations. They had homes built. Family started. Careers. You know, if you're anything like I am, you know what you're going to do as an alcoholic especially. Double up and catch up. You know, and this is the way I hit civilian life. I went into business. I built a tri-level home. I got married. I started that family. The business I went into was immediately successful. I'd grown up in it, and I've been in it most of my sober years. You guys contributed an awful lot to it in your drinking careers. It's called the auto body business. But it was good. I got a better life if I just worked at it 8 hours a day, but I was working 12 and 14 and 16 hours a day. I went to 6 days a week, and then I went on to 2 shifts. I got that tri-level home down there paid for in a short period of time. Got a trust fund started for the kids to get them through college, and hell, they're only 1 and 3. You know, but this is the way we think, and this is the way we drive, and I'd come through those doors at night so damn beat I could hardly hold my head up. Flop in that easy chair, and it was one thing I could always sell right on. Man, if there's anything you've earned yourself today. You know what it was, a drink of booze. I was no better off than I was sweating hangovers at 30,000. strange thing happened to me about this time in my life. Oh, Harry Truman got his foot in his mouth and sicked us on Korea. I was telling you, we hadn't trained any fighter pilots after World War II. He found it out in a hurry, and he had to call the war worries. Guy, just 21 days from the day I was recalled, I looked out there, I got 2 500-pound napalms nailed each wing. Again, they're saying, sick 'em, Tiger. They just went that way. I got another 100 missions to do. You know, I'm 30 years old by this time. Maybe they don't sound old, but it's getting old for a fighter pilot, especially one with a progressive disease. Now, I had no idea I had a progressive disease. Hell, I was still passing Class A physicals every 6 months. How could I have a disease? But when I started to do that new 100 in Korea, something became quite evident to old Red in a hurry. Those damn missions had got too long between drinks. You know, I told you I'd been a daily drinker now for a hell of a long time. I think these chains of alcoholism lie so lightly on our shoulders that a lot of us have no idea that they're there until we're just completely enmeshed. Till all of a sudden we wake up one morning to the fact that we're no longer telling alcohol when we're going to drink it. Booze is beginning to tell us when we're going to drink it. I solved that situation very simply. I went over to the PX and I bought myself 2 8-ounce flasks, one for each winter flight boot. And hell, it worked great. I'd use the right one going out and the left one coming home. A long time after booze started doing to me, it would still do for me. And I think a lot of you can identify with that. I was brought out very vividly to me just how hooked I was really getting. Along about my 40th mission, I got shot up again for about the umpteenth time in my life. Shell come through the bottom of the airplane right through my left leg, and it kicked it clear into my chin. You know, I still remember getting my foot back down on that rudder, and I could feel liquid running into that left winter flight boot. I still remember sticking my hand down there and pulling her back and thinking, hot dog, it's blood. Only alcoholics identify with that story. I thought they'd shot my coming home jug out. That's what I thought. I still had 30 minutes to make it home, and I was damn glad to find my medication still intact. This is the way alcohol was letting me think. I finished my 100. I got back here to the States. I got to think, you know, maybe, Red, you could find yourself a flying job far enough away from booze. Maybe you can find yourself a job where it's not so readily available. As usual, the Air Force come up with it. They were just starting to build the radar sites up across the Arctic Circle. I went north. If any of you are thinking about that, my God, forget it. I spent a year in Thule, Greenland, where the warmest day we had was 23 below. So cold weather will not do it. It just won't do it. I finally volunteered to come on back down to Harmon, that big Seagram's distillery that they have in Newfoundland, to pick up the monthly ration of booze for that base up there. Thule's only about 450 miles from the North Pole. I brought down a twin-engine airplane that afternoon and loaded her clear down those big 40-ounce Canadian jugs of that CC and VO. I started back up there that night, and I got into one of the damnedest Arctic storms I was ever in, and I lost an engine. It was one of those nights I called Air Sea Rescue, and those bastards wouldn't even come out. You know, and I fought that thing all night long, and I got into Thule just at Arctic dawn, and the whole base was down there to meet me. I got to thinking, isn't it great they're that worried about old Red? I rolled back that wind, and the first thing they asked me is, you didn't salvo that load, did you? It had never even crossed my mind. I don't know if you guys had this problem or not. As a daily drinker, I was developing a hell of a smell problem. You know, when you drink booze all day like I did, you begin to smell like booze all day. I got to think, you know, maybe if I'd get back to Europe where they got that wine on the table to eat a lot of garlic, that at least I'd blend in better. I volunteered for Fleet Line Service, which is the airline that resupplies NATO. I went back over. You know, my northern run was Brussels, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. Now, those are progressive disease towns, I'll guarantee you. It never got better. I was picking up a lot of rank over the years. They kept trying to trap me for command. They got it done. They jerked me back here to the States, sent me through staff and command school, gave me an air defense group, stuck me over to Hamilton, just outside of San Francisco. God, now I got 800 men in my command. You know, I'd hear my airplanes roll every morning. It seemed like invariably I'd look out there at that outer office, and that adjutant of mine would always have about a half a dozen of my boys sitting out there waiting for me to talk to. I found an awful lot of my mornings used to be taken up counseling. You know, these kids had been in town getting themselves into all kind of trouble, most of it drinking. I had a system. I had an eyes-on safe alongside of my desk. Used to keep a 40-ounce jug of Smirnoff Red Vodka in there with a hooked glass straw. Every time he'd go out to get one of those boys, I'd hit the safe. And usually by noon, I was giving some pretty damn good lectures on the evils of drink. Also knew I was going to get in a lot of trouble sooner or later. The Air Force had always been awful good to me all my life. I figured I sure as hell owed them a lot more than I was giving them anymore. And again, I submitted my resignation. This time it didn't work. My resignation got as far as Air Defense Command in Colorado Springs. They reviewed it and bounced it. They bounced it with a recommendation that I be sent to Parks, which is one of the big Air Force hospitals, for 3 months psychoanalysis. Thought I was suffering after three tours of duty from combat fatigue. You know, I couldn't very well go in and tell them what I was suffering from. If I had any other terminal disease in this world, I'd have been in there on that doctor's doorstep every morning, laying the symptoms on him. You know, telling him, God, doc, this is where it hurts. Yet you can drag that dying alcoholic into that same doctor's office, read him that same set of questions when it comes to that one where it says, do you drink excessively? Oh, a couple of beers now and then, doc. Self-denial, the greatest symptom of all the symptoms I've been trying to describe. Our complete lack of our innermost selves to get honest enough to admit that alcohol is just taking us to pieces. Now, alcoholism back in those days was not even considered a treatable disease. They recommended 3 months psychiatric help, one of the big Air Force hospitals. I had to spend that 3 months on that psych ward in order to get out of service. I don't believe that psychiatry could possibly help the practicing alcoholic due to the self-honesty bit. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't believe there's anybody in here this afternoon that probably psychiatry couldn't help just a little bit. I'm going to tell you my psych story. Now, it fits in with mine down the line. This guy had an obsession. He had an obsession. He had a purple screw for a belly button. He knew it was an obsession, but every time he looked down, there's that bright purple screw right where his belly button should be. He finally goes to this shrink. He says, Doc, can you help me? He says, I haven't had a good night's sleep in months. Doc looked him over. He says, I think I can. He says, I just got this new potion in. He says, I want you to take it home with you. Get in your best pajamas. Open your bedroom window. Drink this stuff down. He says, you're going to drift right off to sleep. In will float a little pink cloud. It'll have a little yellow-handled screwdriver on it. He says, unscrew that thing. Lay it up there. Let it float out, and you get your night's sleep. He looked at him and says, Doc, I'm going to try it. He went running home. He went through the routine, and it worked. In floated the little cloud. He unscrewed it. Out it floated. Got the night's sleep he'd been looking for months. Woke up the next morning completely refreshed. Covers were up. Finally got his nerve up, picked up the covers, and took a look. Sure enough, a normal belly button. He was just elated. He jumped out of bed, and his ass fell off. Now, the reason I tell you this story is it's exactly the way that psychiatry worked for Red. They would fix me up. They'd say, you're ready, Tiger. I'd jump out there and off it'd fall again. Incidentally, I was on that ward 3 months. I had three appointments with those doctors a week for that full 3 months. You know, the club on that base opened at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it closed at 1 o'clock in the evening. I had open post to that club. I used to open it every day at 1 o'clock and close it at 1 o'clock in the evening. In that three-month period, those doctors never saw me that I wasn't bombed out of my mind. And yet, in that whole medical report, there's not one mention of the word alcoholism. You see, they didn't even know it was a treatable disease back in those days. They did let me out. Family's long since got tired of my shenanigans and been on their way. My folks had moved out here to the West Coast, and they'd been real successful. Had a big home over there on top of Palo Verde Hills behind San Pedro. I figure I'll get up there in that big den with that boob tube and that beautiful view of Los Angeles Harbor. All the pressures I've been drinking at over a lot of years are off my back. I'm going to get a handle on this drink. I lasted about 2 weeks up there, and I was going out of my gourd. It was one of those big wooden globes, one of those big Columbus-type globes sitting in that den. I kept looking at that thing and thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you've never taken a true geographic. I'd always been around guys that could cover for me, guys that had flown combat with or gone to school with. I figured if I'd get someplace in this world far enough away from anybody that knew me, that I'd have to do it on my own. I run my finger up over the meridian to see what was on the other side of the world from Palo Verde. If you want to try it, it's Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. 1 month later, I was flying captain on Ethiopian Airlines. Halfway around the world again. Nobody knows Red. All he knows is he's got lots of flying time and he's qualified. I gave it my best shot. I don't know whether any of you guys tried white-knuckle sobriety or not, but I stayed sober a year on guts. And if you're thinking about it, my God, forget it. It was the most miserable year I ever spent in my life, before or since. But when a waking moment in that year, I didn't want to drink. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, have to go down to the kitchen, pour myself one, set it on a table and sweat it. Not drink it. Prove yourself you got guts enough, Brad. Go to a movie and I have to get up in the middle of it and go to the bar and have the bartender pour me one. Not drink it. Sit there and sweat it. That's the way I went through the year. And if you want to hang out there as long as Red did and you live, that's exactly what it's going to do to you. I kept right on with that kind of a crappy existence till I finally got so bad they even quit hiring me for it. I was back here in the States. I was 41 years old. I guess probably I was about as unemployable as a guy can really get. I figured it wasn't too many things I hadn't tried a couple times in this world. If I couldn't whip it, at least I could get with it. I bought myself 10 cases of those 40-ounce jugs of that Smirnoff Red Vodka, and I stuck them in that hillside over there in Palo Verde. And I went on what was supposed to be old Red's last drunk. This was 31 years ago, before detox or care centers or hospitals that have anything to do with an alcoholic. People who were on the side of that hill had no idea what was wrong with me. I'd been out there among them since I was 18. They'd really never been around me that often. They knew I was getting awful sick physically. That drunk lasted 64 days, and the last 30 of it I hadn't eaten. My normal weight's 220. I was down to 138 pounds of emaciation, and most of that was liver. I think God stepped into my life about this time. Those people picked a doctor out of the phone book to see if he'd make a house call. And you know that doc actually made that house call. I know today that he didn't do it because of his Hippocratic Oath. They happened to pick one that's a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. He listened to those symptoms over the phone. He made that house call and he told those people what I was up against. Said he'd seen some amazing recovery on a program that he himself was trying. That he was going to do what he could for me physically and he was going to leave some names and if I asked for help to call you. I don't remember ever getting that well. He thought I was going to die, and they thought I was going to die. So I guess they just called you. Because my first recollection of you sober guys were those guys sitting on the edge of that bed. And they literally nursed old Red back to health. They started hauling me into rooms like this. And man, I was a tongue-chewing, wet-brained, babbling idiot, I'll guarantee you, for that first 30 days. But thank God you read this portion of Chapter 5. Like Jan did for the meeting, because I think that's what saved Red's life. I wasn't capable of hearing too much. I could hear, just don't drink today. And then they'd read those 12 suggested steps. And all of a sudden, sitting at that old maritime meeting over there in Wilmington one Saturday night, about 30 days sober, they had just read that portion of Chapter 5. And it all come crashing in, what I'd been trying to put together, what I was trying to identify with. You see, for many years, drunk or sober, the only thing that had ever kept me alive in those complicated airplanes I'd been flying was called a checklist. A list in which everything I had to do to get through one flight was written down. I'd never gone near a bird in my life, drunk or sober, that I hadn't used that checklist from the time I walked up until the time I walked away. And it'd get me through just one flight. Sitting back there that night, all of a sudden it dawned on me what 24 hours really is. 24 hours is just one flight in life. And those 12 suggested steps of the checklist to keep you from having to go out there and pick up that first drink of booze. I've been using that 12-step checklist now on a daily basis for the last 30 years. I've never found myself necessary to go back out there and pick up that drink of booze. Never had to smoke any funny grass. Haven't had to take any tranquilizing, sedating pills. I've probably been as close to chemically free as a guy can stay in this modern world. And I owe it all to you guys. See, on my own, I've given it my best shot, and I've never scratched the surface. Everything I've been talking about this afternoon, I've learned in rooms like this. If you got your hand up this afternoon and you said, my name is, whatever it was, and I'm an alcoholic, you pretty well got that number one step nailed. That's what we're talking about. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. And that's just about what you're able to do when you hit your feet in front of a bunch of your peers and say, my name is Red, and I'm an alcoholic. If you're anything like I was, though, and you hit that step number two, that thing will just jar the living hell out of you. You know, there's a real inference in that step. I'm going to have to ask a power greater than old Red to restore me to sanity. Before I can even take that step, I got to admit I'm nuts. I got to admit I had to be. Where else would you find a guy completely allergic to a drug that if he continued to use it was going to kill him that went out there and pumped it down a couple of fifths a day? You know, there's got to be all kind of insanity in us before we ever come through those doors. Don't let it shake you too much. I'm going to tell you my insanity story. For years, by the time I'd get my shop closed in Long Beach and get out to Buena Park and change clothes and then double back up to places like this, I was always driving like a son of a gun to get there in time. This guy was doing the same thing. He was on the freeway. He had a meeting he had to be at in about 10 minutes. His off-ramp was coming up. He thought he had it nailed. He hit the off-ramp, got a couple of blocks down the street, and blew a tire. He jumped out, and it sure as hell flat. He thought, well, maybe I can still make it. He ran around, jerked his trunk open, got his spare out, jacked his car up, whipped his lug nuts off, put him in a hubcap behind him. He just set his spare up. Car come whizzing along behind him, caught the edge of the hubcap, and flipped all his lug nuts right out in the weeds. And he's frantic. He's out there beating these weeds to death, and it's dark, and he can't find them, and he's wringing his hands. He knows he's going to be late. All of a sudden, he heard a voice. He hadn't paid any attention where he'd rolled to a stop. He looked up, and he was parked right in front of an institution for the alcoholically insane. One of the inmates had been sitting up there on a fence watching all this, and he says, hey, mister. And the guy says, I haven't got time to talk to you right now. He says, I'm in a hell of a hurry. The guy sitting up on a fence says, you know, I've been sitting up here watching you. He says, I figured you must be. He says, hell, if I was in that big a hurry, he said, I'd take the other three hubcaps off, take a lug nut off of each wheel, put that thing on there and get going. The guy looked at him and says, my God, that's the answer, isn't it? He says, how did you come up with that? I thought you were insane. The guy says, well, I am, but that's no sign I'm stupid. The point I'm trying to make is this. All of us, when we come through those doors, are a wee bit bent out of shape. We've been out there kicking ourselves around for a hell of a long time. The mere fact that we come looking for help sure as hell proves that we're not stupid. This is where the answers are, in rooms like this. Guys and gals sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other that we can solve this common problem. I hit that step number three. I have a feeling all of you know what happened. I went into that word God. I went running from my sponsor and I said, Mac, is that the God they're talking about? He says, yeah, Red. And I said, I got 250,000 years in purgatory to do before I could even start this program. He says, you didn't read the small print. I said, what's that? He says, a God of your understanding. Now, I knew I was going to have to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than Red because I had really loused it up. And you know, all of a sudden it dawned on me that there was a power right there in front of me. You guys. group power. Man, I could believe in group power. I've been tucked up in groups all my life. As long as I was in the group, I had all the firepower in the world. It was only when I was out there as a straggler I was going to get my ass shot down. I started hanging with the winners, the guys that had some time on this program. I started listening to them. I started picking their brains. And they taught me. They taught me real good about this power that the Dale Red calls God. My sobriety on a daily basis is a gift from you guys and God. What I do with that sobriety is my gift back to Him. You see, He's let me become part of that pipeline of information started with that first 100 guys and a gal. The only way I can keep it is to keep giving it away. I got to be standing at a podium or at that door when the new guy or the new gal comes through. I got to have my hand out and share my experience, strength, and hope with them like they did with me when I come through that door. This is the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got down to the end of that checklist. It said, having had a spiritual awakening, and you know, nothing had happened. I got to go to a convention about my first 60 days. I heard an old boy from the podium, and he sounded spiritual. He sounded spiritual every time I ever heard him after that. Passed away down Laguna a few years back. A lot of you knew him. I took him aside after that convention. I said, come on, Chuck, tell me about spiritual. And he says, I'm glad you asked, Red. He said, I did a lot of research on it. He says, I come up with a definition. And I said, that's what I'm looking for, something this alky brain can handle. He said, Red, spiritual is that which is not material. You know, I started reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous real conscientiously to find out what that first 100 guys and a gal had in mind when they put that in there. And you know, the more I read it, the more I became convinced what they were talking about were my attitudes and my emotions. These are the things that had always driven me back out there to pick up that first drink. Alcohol was merely a symptom of what was wrong with me. My attitudes prior to finding you guys, when I'd step out there and take a look at a day, was, oh God, another day. And they'd been that way for a long, long time. What you guys have taught me is to step out there and take a look at a day and say, thank God, another day. See, I've been granted one I shouldn't have had. The average age of death when Red hit this program was 41. And I told you a minute ago how old I was. I just barely snuck in. It means that every day that I've been granted over the last 30 years, a day at a time, is a gift from you guys and God. And you can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. I get up to a podium like this, I get right up on cloud nine. I got to tell you my attitude story. This guy walked into a barbershop not too long ago. He was right up on cloud nine. The barber got him in the chair. He says, what are you so happy about? The guy says, I got a 747 reservation going to Rome. He said, I'm going over there and eat some of that good Italian food. He said, I even got an audience with the Pope. The barber looked at him and says, what's the matter with you, man? He says, that 747 is the roughest airplane in the sky. He says, you'll be airsick all the way over there. He says, you start eating that Italian food and Montezuma's revenge is going to seem mild. He says, you know the Pope isn't going to have time for a commoner like you. The guy had gone in there right on cloud nine. Now, he came out after the haircut right down in the pits, you know, right where those norms usually drop me. He didn't see him for 30 days, and all of a sudden a guy hit the door and he is really out of sight this time. He got him back in the chair and he says, what now? He says, I made that trip. He says, that 747 is the smoothest airplane in the sky. He said, what a ripple going over. He said, I gained 10 pounds eating that Italian food. He said, it was the best I ever had. He said, I even got my audience with the Pope. I got to kneel at his feet, kiss his ring, and he says, would you believe he even had a question for me? The barber says, what could he have possibly asked you? He says, he asked me, where did you get that lousy haircut? Don't let him tear you down. I can't guarantee you get your wives, your husbands, your kids, your health, your jobs back. But I can guarantee you that those 12 suggested steps are going to give you the tools to start digging into that pile of stuff you brought through the door. And if you use them as tools, I can also guarantee you're going to start to uncover in a hurry something that you can live with pretty comfortably on a daily basis for as long as you want to hang around this program. So much for attitudes. about emotions. You know, in five different places in this big book, it refers to one thread, the one trend that seems to run through all our personalities as alcoholics is a little thing called emotional immaturity. How could a 41-year-old fighter pilot be emotionally immature? I had a hard time buying that in the beginning. I don't today, because over a period of the last 30 years, it's probably the one character defect that I've had to work on almost constantly. I looked up that word immaturity in the dictionary, and you know what it said? Childlike. From the very first time that flight surgeon handed me that drink of booze in that interrogation line many years ago, my emotions had shut down. I'd never had to grow up. I'd always had a crutch. It's brought out very vividly to me every Saturday morning out here at Buena Park where I live exactly what they're talking about. This has been going on for the last 30 years. About 9 o'clock every Saturday morning, there's a knock on a Red's front door. It's all the kids in the neighborhood gathered out there on my lawn wanting to know if I can come out and play. And I do. Every once in a while, my wife comes to the door and they say, "Oh, it's Red's mother." I could never figure out how I got along with kids so well. I have all my life. I realize today that the reason I always had is because their emotions were my emotions. You see, I had never had to talk down to them. I talked directly to them, just like I'm talking to you, emotionally immature jokers. You know what I'm talking about. Did you ever see one of those little guys get mad? He gets red-faced, fist clenched, drawn back, swinging, angry, mad. Now, who does this remind you of? He'll pick up a resentment and he won't talk to the rest of us for the rest of the day. He's going to punish us. Anybody identify with those kind of emotions? See, it's no wonder we come into rooms like this and start growing up together. Some of those kids that come knocking on that door have been doing it for well over 25 years. Some of those kids that used to put their wheels back on their skateboards, now I'm helping port and relieve their automobiles, and we still got a good thing going. And when they got in trouble with that crap that's out there on the street this afternoon, they knew where to bring themselves and their buddies. And I've had a lot of luck in that direction, and I'd have missed it. I'd have missed it all if it hadn't been for you guys. I still have seems like after 30 years, Red's will and God's will would start to kind of come together like this. But you know, they keep staying right on that same parallel all the time. I heard a story over in Vegas kind of illustrates what I'm talking about. This guy must have been a really, really practicing alcoholic. He'd been out of work all during that slow period we had. He finally got himself a good job in a supermarket on the produce department, keeping all the lettuce and tomatoes and vegetables and fruits and everything laid out, wet down, looking good. All of a sudden, one afternoon, this guy come walking in, cornered him. He says, "Young man, I want to buy half a head of your lettuce." The kid looked at him and says, "I'm sorry, sir, we don't sell half a head of lettuce." Now, I've been dealing with the public for the last 30 years, and I know how irritating they can get when they want to be. This guy wouldn't let up. He just stayed right in the middle of him. He says, "Hey, I'm a bachelor. Look at the price of that stuff." He said, "It'd just go to waste. Sell me a half a head of lettuce." Kid stuck with his guns. He says, "No, sir, we don't sell it that way." The guy wouldn't let up. He says, "Why don't you go back and ask your store manager whether he'll sell me a half a head?" And by this time, the kid is steaming, and I can understand those kind of emotions. He goes charging back into that store manager's office. He says, "There's some half-assed character out here that wants to buy half a head of lettuce." He turned around, and the guy had walked in right behind him. And he says, "And this gentleman here would like to buy the other half." Difference between Red's will and God's, huh? I don't know if you guys have this trouble or not. I don't have too much trouble turning my will and my life over to the care of God after 30 years. But I still have an awful lot of trouble leaving it there for any length of time. You know, when it starts getting good, guess who wants to take the credit for it? I'm going to close a little incident that happened to me a couple years ago, just shortly before I retired. I got up one morning here in Buena Park. I had a whole bunch of situations down there at the shop that morning. I really didn't want to go down and handle them. I'm still pretty good at procrastination. I hem and hawed around that house until I finally hit that 91 freeway going to Long Beach running late. Now, even to this day, when old Red hits a freeway running late, strange things begin to happen. People get cut out. Horns get blown. Fingers get given. You know, I'm building a head of steam, and I haven't got to work yet. And whenever I start to act that way, that old monster inside of me begins to lash. That one that used to whip me right over to that corner tavern. I got to run that checklist, and man, I hit that turn it over button, and it's froze in a down position. I haven't turned anything over to God. You know, I talked to him just like I'm talking to you guys. I said, okay, sir, I'll just go down and do the footwork. You handle it. I got down there that morning. None of that stuff that I'd anticipated ever did show up. Everything that did come in, just as smooth as glass. You know, it was a nice day. Nice day all day long. Now, I jumped in that same car that night, headed back out 91 on my way home. Guess who I'm patting on the back for the way I handled that situation? And all of a sudden, it dawned on me what I was doing, and I busted out laughing, and I looked over, and the guys driving on each side of me on the freeway are tuning radios, trying to find out what the hell I'm listening to. But it reminded me of a story I used to use back in my combat days about credit, where credit's due. I had 6 clusters to my DFC, and when I'd wear them, guys would look at me and they'd say, where in the hell did you ever get those, Red? And I used to have a stock answer that I got pushed in the pond. But the story goes like this. It's about a Texas rancher. He had one of the biggest spreads in Texas. Thousands of acres, big old Olympic-sized pool, a barbecue area, rambling ranch house. Just as a conversation piece, he built himself about 150-yard across alligator pond. And he filled it with the meanest damn alligators he could find the world over. These big old 15-foot snappers. And he didn't feed them too good. He kept them mean out there. All these guys got out there one afternoon drinking his booze and telling these war stories. And this Texan finally got a little tired of them. He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, any of you guys really want to prove your courage? Anybody to go down there and swim across that alligator pond? I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage, $1 million or a ranch like mine. Figured he'd shut them up for good. He no more turned his back, and he hears all this commotion. He turned around, and here this guy is swimming out across the pond, and he is moving out. He's leaving a rooster tail. He made it. The Texan ran around and helped him out. He says, I've never seen such a display of courage. He says, I'll stick with my bargain. He says, I imagine you want my daughter's hand. The guy shook his head, and he says, oh, no, sir. He says, I'm already married. He looked at him, and he says, well, then it's got to be $1 million. The guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, I have an income for life. Texan looked at him and he says, well, then it's got to be the ranch like mine. The guy shook his head and he says, no, sir. He says, my daddy left me one in his will. He looked at him and he says, well, what do you want? He says, I want the name of that son of a bitch that pushed me in the pond. You've been a great audience, gang. Just remember, every single one of us in this room this afternoon got pushed into that pond of alcohol. Probably no human power could have ever got us out of there. God can, and He will, if He sought. May you find Him now. May that power watch over us all, a day at a time, through the eternity of our spiritual existence. And I sure want to thank you guys for letting me share.
Let's give Ray another hand.